Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the policies, events and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm Director of ECFR. And today I am joining you from Berlin, where we're going to do a deep dive into the psychodrama which is afflicting its policy towards Ukraine and European defence. We're going to look both at the internal intrigue within the traffic light coalition and between the different parties and different wing arms of government within Berlin. But we're also going to look externally at how Germany is getting on with the rest of the world, particularly its closest European allies after the meeting in Berlin, which brought together the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, with the French President, Emmanuel Macron, and the Polish Prime Minister, Donald Tusk. And to help me make sense of all of this are two returnees to the podcast. First up, we have Jana Plierin, who is a senior policy fellow at ECFR, as well as head of our office in Berlin. And down the line from Paris, we have Ulrike Franke, who is also a senior policy fellow at ECFR. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, so it's been a pretty rough month for German debates about defence, with quite a lot of fights within the German system, but also between Germany and other European countries. And that's all been added to by things that are going on in the real world. The debate about the Taurus missile system in the Bundestag has kind of bled into the scandal of leaks from German military calls and the way that they talk about soldiers being deployed or advisors being deployed in Ukraine. And on top of all that, a German frigate almost shot down a US drone. But maybe we'll start with the internal dynamics. Jana, do you want to give us a window into the German political soul at the moment?
Well, I think there is a quite schizophrenic situation in Germany at the moment because there are basically two Germanys. One is the one the Chancellor talks about and also brags about. He says we are the second largest contributor to humanitarian, financial and military aid to Ukraine. We have this year for the first time managed to spend 2% on defense. I, the Chancellor, am resolutely leading, together with Joe Biden, the Western camp. Together with the US, we do more than any other countries in the world to support Ukraine. Yet, I'm very prudent and I'm trying not to escalate the situation. So this is the first Germany. And the second Germany is basically one that you encounter when you talk to the opposition, but increasingly also to representatives from the Green Party or the FDP, the Liberals, the Germany you can read about in the media. And that is led by a chancellor who is too hesitant when it comes to arms deliveries to Ukraine, who is always basically delaying decisions until the very last moment, who is right to say that Germany is the second largest contributor to Ukraine in total, in absolute terms, but looking at our GDP, we're actually lagging behind. We have antagonized our most important European partners. And yeah, so there is basically a rift that goes through Germany, I think, at the moment. It's a rift between the Chancellor and the Foreign Office. It's a rift between the SPD increasingly on the one hand and the opposition, but also parts of the Traffic Light Coalition. And I would say, I fear that there might be a growing rift between the Scholz SPD and the SPD led by or influenced by Ralf Mützenich, who is the leader of the SPD party group in parliament, who has just in a speech about Taurus or not delivering Taurus, basically talked about freezing the war in Ukraine and trying to bring peace, and has not used Scholz's words about supporting Ukraine as long as it is necessary. And so, yeah, many rifts, I think, that we see in Germany at the moment. Countries not really united.
So, Rika, you've been watching the debate as well from your perspective. What's your sense of what's going on?
Yeah, so the thing I would emphasize the most is that this really is a dispute, as Jana alluded to, that is happening within the governing coalition. This isn't, you know, the opposition against the government in the way that you have it in all democracies, and you always, of course, had it in Germany. I've really been struck by how forcefully, how loudly, how clearly, and sometimes how harshly members of the governing parties, so we're mainly talking kind of MPs that aren't, you know, in government as ministers or something, but still are part of the coalition in the sense that their party is part of the coalition, how harshly some of them have criticized Scholz personally and his Ukraine policy, and specifically around the towers delivery or non-delivery over the last few weeks. I mean, we had the situation that one Green MP, Anton Hofreiter, wrote an op-ed in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, so a kind of conservative newspaper, together with an MP, Norbert Röttgen, from the CDU, the Christian Democrats, really harshly criticizing Scholz's Ukraine policy, the way he kind of handles the potential nuclear threat from Russia and all of that. And I really wondered, like, had I ever seen something like that? I mean, of course, there's always kind of some criticism in coalitions. That's the nature of a coalition government. But I'm really struck by how many divisions we kind of see now within this governing coalition. And even the ministers, Jana alluded to this, there's a bit of a fight or dispute or disagreement between the Foreign Office, led by Annalena Baerbock of the Greens, and the Chancellery, led, of course, by Olaf Scholz. Baerbock is, of course, more diplomatic because she is a minister and foreign minister. But at times it feels as if this coalition is being held together not by agreement, but rather by the fact that no single party of this three-party coalition would have anything to gain by new elections. They would all lose quite massively, depending on which poll you look at, and therefore they can't really separate. But it really doesn't look great. And this really struck me. And maybe final to point, I got the impression that it really shows how in Germany, because of the kind of 30 years of peace we're coming out and the kind of narrative of the end of history and this negligence of all things military and strategic we had over the last decades, it really shows that we do not have a culture of talking about military and defense and strategic things in Germany. Most of the time, my genuine reaction is like, can you just stop talking about this so openly and so controversially and like do this behind closed doors, but we can't do all of this so openly. This is just really bad communication and just doesn't help the whole effort of supporting Ukraine. So it doesn't look great from the outside, I got to say.
So one of the things which I think is maybe worth looking at as well is because it seems to me from the opinion polls and things like that, that this is not actually a debate within German society, that it's a debate within the elite. By and large, 70%, I think, of Germans think Scholz is doing fine on the, you know, they agree with the stance that he's taking on Ukraine.
But only on the Taurus, not on Ukraine more broadly. I think
that's the thing. It's Taurus, which is, maybe you can explain actually, Jana, why Taurus has taken on such an outsized role in the German debate. You know,
I don't know if I can explain. Yeah, I don't know if I can explain
it's an important system, but you know, it does seem to have overshadowed almost everything else. And you know, I don't think it's the single most important problem that Zelensky's facing at the moment, the absence of Taurus.
No, absolutely. But coming back to support for Olaf Scholz, because I think you're right when you look at the broader population's reluctance to support the delivery of Taurus to Ukraine. But Olaf Scholz's approval ratings
are very bad. It doesn't seem to affect him.
And also there is, by and large, a broad consensus still in Germany for supporting Ukraine, including by military means. I think from the beginning of the Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine, the German population has been very much on board and still is on board and is not calling for, reducing the support. I mean, there is a fair share of the population, but I think the government has still a broad majority for its current approach. Coming back to Taurus, I think, is a long-range cruise missile. But for some people, it has become much more. It has become kind of a symbol for Germany's overall stance towards Russia and its support of Ukraine. It has become, I think, much more meaningful than its kind of military meaning for Ukraine. Although I think it would be militarily significant to send the Chars to Ukraine. It would enable Ukraine to reach to attack support lines and to ease the pressure there is on the front lines. But you're totally right. I think it's not a wonder weapon. It would be not a total game changer. But for many people, especially in the elites, Scholz's reluctance, I think, and also the way this reluctance was communicated, coming up with, 10 different reasons. If one was basically debunked, they came up with another one. And all that led to some general skepticism that behind it is that Olaf Scholz is not supporting Ukraine enough, doesn't want Ukraine to win, to really get back its territory. People were wondering, well, is Scholz more afraid basically of Russia winning this war or of Russia being put too much into a corner? So what is it that the German government is actually supporting on the ground? I think it has become a symbol blown out of proportion. Debate has been completely toxic. I think we should leave it behind us because I think by now Scholz has made very, very clear that he is under almost no circumstances going to change his opinion. I don't see this, although he has changed his opinion.
You might want to leave it behind us, but Rika definitely seems to want to come in. She's got two fingers up.
She wants to talk about Taurus.
I actually agree with Jana on a line of leaving Taurus because, you know, Scholz doesn't want to do it. And at one point, you just need to kind of move on. It is not the wonder weapon. Would it be militarily useful for Ukraine? Most definitely. Is it deciding the war? No. So I think, first of all, on kind of polling numbers, I genuinely think that on such specific issues, there is absolutely no point in asking the general population. Why? Well, because I think that if Germany, you know, 6 months ago would have said, by the way, in our latest package of military aid that we're sending to Ukraine, there are also 100,000 missiles, no one would have even noticed because no one had ever heard of Taurus before, you know, outside.
I'm shocked by your elitism, not wanting to fight wars with opinion polls, Rika.
So this is one of those things, and we keep doing this since, I mean, basically already before the war started, but especially since the war started, we keep doing this in Germany where we kind of latch on, kind of focus on one thing and build it up as being like the big step, possibly red line, escalation.
We might have done some podcasts on the leopards.
I was just going to mention the leopards.
So got involved with the leopards.
The latest thing this happened, or the kind of the other big thing where this happened was about Leopard combat tanks. And here the kind of system was the same. It was talked up as saying, you know, this would be a huge, well, change in pace, escalation, however you wanted to frame it. And I remember saying at the time, I mean, I didn't learn in like military science 101 that combat tanks are somehow the change in warfare. And we did this and we had these huge discussions. And I mean, in the end, you know, Germany actually decided to send Leopard tanks and they play a really important role. But of course, it also didn't win the war. And we're doing the same with Taurus. And the big problem I see with this is not only is it totally blown out of proportion, it doesn't help us in the sense that it creates a possible escalation where there shouldn't be one. Because imagine that Scholz actually changes his mind, which I don't think he will, and now decides to deliver Taurus. That would actually be seen, I mean, anywhere, and especially in Moscow, as a type of escalation, not because this weapon is so much more important than anything else, but because it has talked up so much. And so I think we're really standing in our own way and creating these situations that are extremely unhelpful, especially for the Ukrainians, but in general for our foreign policy. And that is what I find so frustrating. This, you know, of course, you know, military experts are pretty much agreeing on the fact that Taurus would be very useful for the Ukrainians for certain types of attacks. But if, you know, given how much Germany is doing, and I think, you know, it is worth underlining this, you know, you can definitely say this is something we don't want to do for various reasons, be they legal or political or anything else. But this has become such a big thing, and this is our own fault. And that is what I find so frustrating in a way.
So I think Jana wants to come back in and defend her leopard plan, but also
exactly.
Maybe while you're at it, Jana, you could also just talk a bit, because we should pivot quite soon to looking at the international situation, but maybe just say a bit more about what you think is going to happen. You know, there's some speculation, even in our internal ECFR chat rooms, not speculation, but questions about whether this coalition might fall. You know, what might happen? Is it going to kind of limp on to the next election? What, you know, how important are these political disagreements internally? And they obviously come on top of a lot of quite difficult, more structural things than the Taurus thing about the debt break, which I think is something which is having a really big impact on German defense spending. So maybe you can talk about that, but you know, feel free to
first. To my own rescue. I want to come to my own rescue by just saying that this emphasis on one weapon system and kind of this idea that this would change the war entirely has not been part of, I think, our thinking, not been part of my thinking or other colleagues who have written this Leopard plan back at the time. We have always emphasized that this is just one tool, but a very crucial one, but that it needs to be accompanied by other measures, and that we need to have a comprehensive approach towards supporting Ukraine.
I was criticizing the government. I feel that this isn't people who said we should deliver them or not. No one was actually making the kind of one no weapon argument. What I mean is, because of the debate that the government is having and because of this kind of back and forth and not doing stuff, like, they build it up to something extreme.
We were accused of kind of selling it as a wonder weapon, and I just want to emphasize that we never did. But coming back to Mark's other point, on is this government going to last? So I think, as Rike said in the beginning, we have seen this in the Taurus debate, actually, because the opposition has, I think, by now three times forwarded their kind of proposal that they wanted to force the government to deliver the Taurus. But the Greens and the Liberals, although in the debate being very critical, still stand with this coalition and still support the Chancellor. And I think that shows you that despite all the disagreements and also, I think, the very negative mood in this coalition on many fronts, they still stick together for the time being. And I think they will not break up this coalition over support for Ukraine or how to confront Russia. But the budget negotiations that are ahead of the government will be very, very difficult, because for the time being, there is a huge, I think, 5 billion gap when you look at the next budget, and there is no solution to it. And basically, because of the special constellation of the three parties, it will be very difficult to find a compromise, because you can either raise taxes, which the Liberals don't want, or you can basically change the debt brake or make an exemption or whatever, which basically the Liberals also don't want to do. You could cut social spending, which is very difficult to do because many of these things are legally difficult to cut. But there is also big reluctance coming from the SPD and the Greens when it comes to cutting social welfare. And so for now, they haven't found a solution to the problem, but they are still committed to spending 2% for the foreseeable future. And also, the Chancellor has basically said that if he is re-elected, he is ready for spending 2% in the 20s and 30s. But looking at how difficult the negotiation about the budget was last time, after the Constitutional Court came forward with the verdict, I really think that this will be really, really tough to just find a solution and to overcome the difficulties and to finance everything that this government still wants to do, because they still haven't given up on the other transformation project, the green transformation, the digital transformation. And So that is something I am going to watch very closely. And last point, I think the whole debate is already very much affected by elections. So we have the EP elections upcoming. We have the three regional elections in the former GDR countries. And then next year we have the big federal election. And sitting here in Berlin, it already feels as if election campaign has basically started and will not end for the next 530 days. This is a very frustrating prospect, actually.
Okay, so I think before we switch from shedding greater light and explaining the German political psychodrama to becoming part of it, we should look outwards at the European angles. One of the most striking ways that the German internal debates have been internationalized came out of the meeting on Ukraine in Paris, which we all kind of watched, when Emmanuel Macron said various things which started a big debate, and then Olaf Scholz responded in his own ways. Rieke, you were sitting in Paris and were watching that very closely. Do you want to talk a bit more about both, you know, I think a lot of people saw what happened, but, you know, how that's played out. And the latest round in that particular thing was this meeting, which we talked about at the very beginning of the podcast, of the Weimar Triangle, of the German and Polish prime ministers and the president of France in Berlin at the end of last week.
Yeah, so we had a very, let's call it, unfortunate week for German foreign policy and security and defense policy. And actually the whole row between Macron and Scholz over the non-exclusion of sending ground troops, and I'll get to this in a second, was just one of them from a foreign policy point of view. So the week actually started with something else, which was that Olaf Scholz made a statement in front of the press kind of explaining why he didn't want to deliver Taurus missiles. And in his answer, he alluded to or basically said that the French and the Brits have some people on the ground in Ukraine to kind of help with their missiles. This was then, by the way, repeated in the leaks of the discussion between high-level Luftwaffe officials that were intercepted by Russia and leaked by RT. So this was put out there, and I cannot overemphasize how pissed the Brits in particular were about this and still are, and the French as well, but especially the Brits, and are really concerned over the security of their people. And I had a number of discussions last week around this, and I don't think this has necessarily registered with the Germans as much as it should have. So this is one part of the story. And the other part of the story is what you mentioned, the kind of Paris conference. So Emmanuel Macron invited a number of heads of government and heads of state in Europe for a conference on Ukraine, kind of supporting Ukraine. And it's actually, from what I hear, it was like a reasonably good conference, and there were good things coming out of it. And he kind of listed them, you know, increased support for Ukraine and more ammunition and buying ammunition, not just in Europe, but also elsewhere. And, you know, it kind of sounded all good. And then there was a question from a journalist that Macron responded to and said that he would not, that this possible, the possibility of sending troops to Ukraine, so European troops to Ukraine, had been discussed at the meeting, that there was no consensus, but that he would not exclude anything because, you know, a war is kind of in movement, in flux. He could have stopped there, which would already have kind of caused a discussion. Unfortunately, he continued and very clearly, although not openly, criticized Germany in particular, talking about those who always excluded stuff and then had to do it anyway. And we needed to be humble about this. And, you know, first you say you don't want to send helmets or you don't want to send tanks, and then you do it. It was very clearly aimed at Germany. And of course, Olaf Scholz responded to all of this in a way that I found extremely unhelpful, because he didn't just say, which I think would have been his perfect right to do, he didn't just say, Germany will absolutely never send soldiers to Ukraine, which again, he can do, even though, I mean, in the end, it's the parliament who decides, but still, he actually said there will be no troops from NATO or European states in Ukraine, and that he simply cannot say, especially not a day after the French president had just said that he is not, in fact, excluding sending troops himself. So it was and is all still very weird, because there's a clear difference in view, but also, and this is more fundamental, what I really see here as someone who has been kind of studying Franco-German relations for over a decade, what I really see here is a difference in strategic culture really shaping communication and the way that things are being seen. Because Macron, I mean, yes, he's also kind of trying to provoke. He's really worried. He is trying to kind of make the Europeans do more. But in the end, what he really wanted to push was this idea of strategic ambiguity, of not telling Putin what we're not going to do and kind of leaving it a little bit open. And Germany, at least under this chancellor, just doesn't do that, for better or worse. And you can have, you know, a view on this, but he just basically said he's excluding a lot of things. And so the nicest thing I heard about Germany in Paris over the last week is, you know, they don't do strategic thinking. And I've heard things that are way meaner than that. So not great.
But you might have said that if you wanted to create strategic ambiguity, a good way of doing it might have been to talk to some other countries before you make the announcement, so they immediately shut it down and remove the ambiguity.
I always say that he wanted to create strategic ambiguity and then create a strategic cacophony in Europe, so no one knows what anyone is going to do. I mean, that criticism is not really fair in the sense that the ground troop thing was discussed. I mean, this is not, he said this, everybody said this, there's no consensus about it, but it was discussed. There even was a non-paper or something rotating, which is exactly what the question was about. So this isn't something that, you know, France didn't coordinate on the contrary. What he didn't coordinate on, and that of course is not clever, is this statement of kind of saying, you know, we're not excluding it. And clearly he wanted to kind of push the Europeans and he wanted to send a message to Moscow and all those things. And you can criticize him for that, but that there was no discussion on that. I mean, at this point, no one says that.
But I think some Germans, at least, I think especially in the Chancellery, but me personally as well, were also a bit annoyed because kind of Germans, think tankers, we always have this tendency to criticize ourselves and our lack of support for Ukraine and the Taurus decision and the Leopards, but we never look at other countries and criticize there. And I think here, when you look at what France is basically saying and what France is actually doing and delivering, there is a huge gap.
Definitely.
And I think that also contributed to some frustration because seen from Berlin, we are the second largest supporter in total numbers.
I just want to say that again, Jan.
No, I'm not the chancellor. I'm trying to limit myself here, but it is a fact, and I don't want to belittle it. And looking at the French numbers, I think there is a legitimate reason to be pissed now from the German side, because I mean they get all the criticism and not enough praise, whereas others like Macron later on, especially in Germany, was seen by many experts as, oh, he's the real strategic thinker and the Germans are just not getting it. And so,
although I totally agree with you, but it's kind of the government's own fault. And again, something that really has been continuing since the beginning of the war, in that they or we as Germany aren't getting the credit they maybe should be getting, because the communication is so terrible, because it always seems as if they're being, you know, as if they had to do things kicking and screaming and didn't actually want to do them. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the numbers are a huge difference. And it is, I think it's a very legitimate criticism of Macron.
Was it 5 or 6 times the size of the French contribution, the German contribution? I mean, it's not even close, is it?
But I just want to bring one last point up before we close. I know that our time is up, but for me, there is something deeper going on here. I think both countries, Germany and France, are looking at the devastating situation in Ukraine. Both countries fear that Ukraine might lose this war. And the prospect of a defeat of Ukraine leads to basically different conclusions. Macron seems to be suggesting that we cannot accept this. And if there is a situation, if it is going to be tense, we need to be there and we need to go in. in some form or another. Whereas, as I said, in Germany, it's not the chancellor so far, but leading members of the SPD have started to talk about the possibility of a freeze or of a ceasefire. And in a way, I think there is a broader question here. Do both countries in the end, or will they agree on the path forward? What do we want to achieve in Ukraine? What is acceptable? And if the situation gets dire, do we then basically escalate or de-escalate, if that is even possible? Maybe we will not have any option because Putin calls the shots anyway, but I think there are different takes here.
But before we do that, because I think that's a really important point that you're making about these different approaches. I was in Warsaw on Friday of last week, and it was the day when the three people met. We should talk a little bit about what came out of this Weimar meeting. But it's quite interesting how, on the one hand, the Poles in private, when I spoke to senior government people, they were much more positive about German contributions to Ukraine than any German think tanker I've ever met. And they were saying, if you think about what we could realistically have expected from Germany, what they've done is like way in advance of anything that you might have imagined would have been possible 2 years ago. But at the same time, and actually, they seem to be very close to Germany on some questions, like, for example, where European Peace Facility and other money can be spent, that, they agree with the Germans about buying stuff off the shelf rather than just buying for European products, which the French want to do. But at the same time, there has been this remarkable strategic rapprochement with between Warsaw and Paris. When everyone was slagging Macron off in the way that they do every single time he gives an interview or makes a speech around Europe, it always creates these cries of pain from different places. But the few people who were out, defending him in public were, included the Polish foreign minister. It's quite an interesting thing that the Poles seem to be positioning themselves closely to Germany on some issues, closely to France on other issues, but also keen to insert themselves into the relationship to try and make it a bit less dysfunctional. So anyway, that's a long way of asking what actually came out of the Weimar meeting.
I think it was so good that they met in the first place. It was such a good signal. And I think that in private, they have talked about exactly the way forward and basically a long-term strategy for Ukraine and how to align diverging views, a more risk-averse view, a more how to characterize Macron's ambitious, forward-leaning approach. And I think the Poles can play a very good role here. From the outside, so far, I have to say that I would have loved to see a bit more to come out of the Weimar meeting. The things that were presented in the press conference were mostly things that were already discussed prior, especially in Paris, and had been decided either in Paris or on the EU level. I think it was good to talk about using the proceeds of the frozen Russian assets to buy weapons for Ukraine and to use it for the European Peace Facility, this kind of new weapon coalition for artillery. Sounds interesting. But for me, the question really is, do these three countries get their act together to support Ukraine in the short term and not launch long-term programs, which is also necessary because we are in it for the long run when it comes to the conflict with Russia. But time is of the essence. And I think the situation in Ukraine is really not great. And so that would be the basically test for me, whether the countries manage to have some, really concrete ideas how to improve the situation. But I'm happy that they met. I'm grateful for the Poles to try to, do some couples therapy here with the Germans and the French. And I wish them all success. There is maybe we can mention it here, but there will be a meeting also of the foreign ministers later in May. So it seems that all three countries really want to work in this framework, which hasn't been the case for a long time. And so, as a good European, I'm really, really putting my hopes on them.
So, last word to you, Rika. Did this meeting leave you with renewed hope for European leadership on Ukraine and for the future of Germany's relations with its closest neighbors?
I wouldn't go so far. I would say they played it really safe. I mean, it was a clear show of unity. They all said really nice things about each other, sometimes in exactly the same phrasing. There were no questions allowed afterwards, so no one could go off script. So this was really playing it safe. But I think, you know, Jana already said it. It's good they did this. I think this is good for the Poles in a way, because it gives them and Tusk a very important role bringing these two partners together and kind of form a coherent role, a whole again with these three countries rather than two. So this is a good development. But yeah, in the end, I think it's really worrisome that, as Jana said, the situation in Ukraine is problematic and it can turn. And I think we need to be aware of this. And I genuinely think Paris and Macron personally and the kind of experts here are really worried, which is why I don't think that this is Macron grandstanding, just making yet another speech, all of this. I think there's a genuine worry in Paris that this is not going the right way. And so there is a clear urgency. And at the same time, we're kind of allowing ourselves to have these internal, inner European disputes, which are only in part based on genuine disagreements on the content. I mean, you know, some things we disagree on, and that's fine. But I think many things have just kind of been built up too much, and that is really unhelpful. So hopefully the Weimar Triangle and all of this can help with that.
Great. Well, we've run out of time now. I can promise you we'll have more discussions on all of these themes, and we probably do a special report from Warsaw, where we've just done this amazing conference called the Warsaw European Conversation with a lot of European government ministers and other people. We talked about Ukraine and defense and elections in Europe, and we'll put up a link to the event on this if people want to spend a day watching it online. Very warmly recommended. But we have one thing left to do on this podcast, and that is our bookshelf segment. What's on your bookshelf, Jana?
I have to confess that I have not been reading for the past 3 weeks because I started a project with my oldest son. We started to watch Breaking Bad on Netflix in English. He's 15, oh, 14 and a half. Basically, we had this deal. We watched this in English, so he improves his English, and we do something together. And I can only recommend it if you have a 14-something-year-old son. It's good for bonding.
I love it.
Great. And what about you, Rika? What have you been watching or reading?
I haven't been watching anything because my son's too little to watch anything. So I'll come back to that in like 13 years. No, I actually have a very boring recommendation on the content of our talk, because I would highly recommend a study that came out already last year, but is still relevant. It's called Zeitenwende, the Bundeswehr's Paradigm Shift. And it is not written by a German think tanker. It is written by two French think tankers, Elie Tenenbaum and Léo Perrier-Peignet from IFRI. And this is such an interesting study of, yeah, the Zeitenwende, what it means for the Bundeswehr, but seen from France. And, you know, talking about differences in strategic culture, for me, this was really quite eye-opening, the things that kind of they highlighted versus the things that maybe I or Jana or who you or anyone else would highlight. So highly recommend it. It's available online, and we can obviously put the link in the show notes.
Great. Fantastic. Well, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please head to whatever platform you use to download this episode and subscribe to future episodes. And while you're there, it would be wonderful if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. We'll put links up to all the publications that we mentioned on our website at ecfr.eu and in the show notes. But for now, from Jana Pouliérine, Ulrike Franke, and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher of ECFL's podcast is Anand Sundar, and our producer is Mireya Farrow-Saratz.